John, we got two nights of NHL hockey down. I think like 178 or something like that. More to go. It's been great. 17 teams have played. Already 66 goals scored. 7.33 per game. Welcome to the hockey season, Sean.
Thank you. I'm overwhelmed by your numbers, though.
I looked them
for
up.
For me, it's the emotion, right? Like, numbers are nice, and when we have a bigger sample size, we can talk about numbers and trends and where they're going. But to me, over the first two nights, it's been about signature moments, right? And none bigger than Connor Bedard, the number one overall pick for the Chicago Blackhawks this year, who, not surprisingly, made his debut on national TV on Tuesday against Sidney Crosby, his idol. Great theater. I thought the miking up of the referee for that opening faceoff between the two, 18 years apart, was fantastic. Welcoming Connor Bedard to the league and all of that. And then, you know, he gets an assist in a game where Chicago comes back and wins. And then two nights later, he's in Boston for their centennial. And he scores his first goal, a beauty wraparound. You see shots of the family, teammates going crazy. Just an unbelievable first 48 hours for one of the signature players in the league already, two games in.
Isn't that amazing? He's already a signature player, but you're right. I mean, listen, you're watching the first two games for the Chicago Blackhawks, a win 4-2 against the Pittsburgh Penguins, a loss 3-1 against the Boston Bruins. By the way, this is Thursday. We're recording this on Thursday. They played Tuesday and Wednesday. The Blackhawks are the only team so far to play two games as we speak right now. And you're watching those games and you're like, where's 98? Where's number 98? And he's present. And more than that, Sean, he's on the ice a lot, okay? Like, this kid's 18 years old. He played 21 and a half minutes against Pittsburgh, and he played 21:44 against Boston. Hello, welcome to the NHL. You're getting ice time galore. Now, some of that's, you know, power play ice time. You know, among that time, he played about 5 minutes per game on the power play, but that's 16, 17 minutes of ice time at even strength, too. They are throwing him right in there, unafraid, and he looks the part. I mean, you talk about numbers, right? Listen, 11 shots on goal. He, in his first game, he had 11 attempts. He had 5 shots, 11 attempts. In his second game, he had 6 shots, 7 attempts. He scored a goal. He's got an assist. He's a point-per-game player already. He looks the part, and the Blackhawks completely unafraid to throw him in there, and rightfully so. I mean, he is now the face of the franchise and a marquee player already. But I got to tell you, I am a little bit surprised that he's playing 21 and a half or a little bit over a night so far in two nights.
I'm not. What's the better option? Who are you going to play more?
There is no better option. It's still a lot for an 18-year-old.
He's your best player. He's your best player. Play him, right? You play Connor Bedard, you play Sidney Crosby, right? Play him. Look, he draws people to him. You look at that goal, the assist he got against Pittsburgh. The reason he got it is because everybody went to him. And Donato's wide open, comes down in the slot and cleans things up, right? After a shot from Bedard. And then, you know, you watch him against Boston, and it's the same kind of thing. He's drawing people to him. He's making these unbelievable moves. And he's handling the rough stuff, right? At one point, Brad Marchand, who does it to the best of him, takes him into the bench, hooks him a little bit, tries to push him over the wall. Connor Bedard just smiled. That's okay. You're dealing with me. Other guys are dealing with the puck. Like, this is part of the NHL. I've watched it for years. Now I get to experience. That's what he said after the game. He's like, Brad Marchand's been doing this for years, and now he's doing it to me. How cool is that?
It's true. And listen, he crashed into the end board. There was a scary moment in that game against Boston, though, him crashing into the end boards and wincing in pain. I was nervous when I was watching. I'm like, oh boy, not in your second game, man. Not in your second game. You got to get up. And he got up, thankfully. It's been a good start. And more than just Bedard. And listen, no matter what we do, Bedard's the focal point of the Blackhawks all season long. But more than just Bedard, I've been impressed with the Blackhawks in general, how they've played. Wayne Gretzky mentioned this on the TNT broadcast Wednesday night during an intermission. They're playing. They're playing hard. Is this going to keep up for 82 games where they're going to stay in games against top teams like Pittsburgh and Boston? I don't think so, okay? I don't. But this team is showing something, and it's more than just Bedard. And I think that's – you're going to look at the positives of Bedard all season long. But for the Blackhawks to build a team that they want to build, you got to look at the positives of the entire team. Through two games, there's a lot of positives.
Yeah, there are. And I think they're going to be better than a lot of people thought, but they're not deep, right? And Taylor Hall gets hurt in one of those games, and now their lines are messed up. Like, there's just not a lot coming behind it. There's nothing to survive injuries, and we all know there's no team in the NHL that's getting through an 82-game schedule without major injuries, never mind bumps and bruises and assorted other things. So that's what concerns me. Look, they're running on adrenaline right now. Every night's an event. They have one of the best players in the league, and he's going out there, and he's showing what he can do and, you know, just wowing people, wowing teammates. And there's an excitement, I think, that goes with that. Like, look at this asset that we have that we're going to be able to build around. And there's a jump in everybody's step. But come 20 games in, and you don't have that jump anymore, and it's become more commonplace, and you're missing two or three guys, I think the Blackhawks are going to be in deep.
Well, they're definitely going to be in deep. We know that. But it's been nice to see them running on adrenaline. It's been great to see Bedard. Listen, in a couple of minutes here, we're going to have an interview with one of our own, Derek Van Deest, our Edmonton staff writer based out of Edmonton. He is actually in Calgary today for the funeral of Chris Snow. But we talk a lot of Western Canadian teams, the Flames, the Jets, the Oilers, with Derek. So that's coming up shortly. And then Tage Thompson from the Buffalo Sabres, who are one of 11 teams to play their first game tonight, Thursday night. There's two more on Friday that will debut, Washington and Arizona. And then the Islanders and the Anaheim Ducks have to wait all the way till Saturday, but they're going to play. And then at that point on Saturday, all 32 teams will have played. Sean, I was in, so the night that Bedard opens up in Pittsburgh, I was in Vegas, as you well know. It was assigned by you to go to Vegas. And it was, I've seen a lot of banner raisings. This one was one of the coolest, if not the coolest, because it was just, it was plain and simple, but yet Vegas style. And I loved it because there were no speeches. There was no podium, no rah-rah like that. It was, here come the Golden Knights. The crowd's going nuts. Mark Stone brings the Stanley Cup out of the Knighthead, smoking Knighthead. He brings it out. They do a lap around the ice. And then the giant slot machine, how Vegas can you get? Stone goes, pulls the lever. Triple Stanley Cups come up, and out comes the banner. And it was just awesome. It was like, it was a great show that they had in Vegas. They always have a great show, but great show without a single word said by a coach, a player, a general manager, an announcer, no MC. I thought it was like perfect for a banner raising ceremony there. What'd you think?
Yeah, no, I liked it. And I think there's a subliminal message there that they're going to win three cups in a row. I think that's what they're trying to do with the slot machine. It was great. Maybe. And what was even better, and what you really like about this Vegas team, is when it was all over, they got down to the business of playing hockey. How often do you see a team raise a banner or a retire somebody's number or whatever? You even saw it a little bit with the Bruins, I thought, with their centennial presentation, you know, and then you go a little flat. You've emptied the tank of emotion. You've been distracted. You were there. You saw them at Monday Night Football with the lighting of the torch and, you know, bringing the cup to the halftime show and everything else that went on. There were a lot of distractions. They were on the banquet circuit for 3 months, right? It's really hard to kind of get that engine revving again. And you looked at this Vegas team after they raised that banner, and they look like a team that was trying to make a statement that they deserve to win a Stanley Cup, not defend one, but win one.
Right. Yeah. 100%. I was somewhat surprised, to be honest with you. And I don't say that in a way to slight the Golden Knights. I just think you're right. I mean, emotion gets the better of you, right? It's gotta be hard to get up for the game after that. And look, the start of the game, Adin Hill kept him in it. He made some big saves, but it didn't take long for Vegas to get a lead, to build on that lead against Seattle, win the game 4-1. It was a really perfect start for Vegas. And I was talking to some guys in the room after the game about how, you know, in the middle point of that game, you're wondering, like, are they going to be able to keep their energy up? And they actually raised it. They raised their energy. They maybe had a little lull up 3-0, but they raised their energy. And you think about what this team had gone through just in the 72 hours preceding opening night. They received their rings Sunday night at a gala fest, at a gala event at the Wynn Las Vegas. Those rings, by the way, George McPhee showed me the ring. That's impressive. Okay? That's an impressive ring.
You know what we need to find out is if our good friend from the Chirp got one.
I think they didn't get him yet. They're going to get him. Darren Millard, I believe, is going to get one. Gary Lawless is going to get one. I think if the rings were given out to the players, the hockey ops staff, the coaching staff, but you know, the rest of the staff there with the Vegas Golden Knights are all getting them. I don't think they're getting the same exact ring, but they're going to get a ring. So Millard's going to come on his podcast and it's not going to actually have any words. It's going to just be a video of him holding his ring up probably, you know. But it's an impressive ring. Like George McPhee, so the top screws off, and the coolest part of that ring, so the top screws off and you can wear it as a pendant. I don't know who's wearing it as a pendant, but you can. Inside,
Darren Millard.
Yeah, maybe Darren Millard. Like Flavor the Clock, it's going to be Darren Millard with the pendant. and like it's inside of it is like a replica T-Mobile Arena. The inside of it, you see replica ice with the Golden Knights logo and little black dots where they scored all of their goals in Game 5 against the Panthers. It's really, really a cool thing. And I was in the restaurant there at their practice facility writing, getting a bite to eat before going to the Monday Night Football game. And George McPhee is like the mayor walking around. And he just comes in to sit and have a bite to eat. And everybody's coming over to him. He's walking around showing everybody his ring. Hey, man, a life in hockey, you want to show it off, right?
That's what you work for. Like, that's the end goal. It shouldn't be put away. It should be worn with pride. Obviously not every day because it's just this huge thing. When I go to next time I go to Vegas, I'm gonna ask Darren if I can borrow his and hit the strip with it.
There you go. You should. People are gonna look at you like that's not the player one. It's not good enough. But you know what? No, what I was saying was Sunday they get their rings, right? Monday they practice. They take the Stanley Cup to the Monday Night Football game, the Raiders-Packers game. And I got to thank, you know, our guy Steve Mayer ended up helping me out, getting me the credential I needed. I had all access, was able to go where they went, was able to get good shots, good fit pictures, a video, really got in there. So that was great. Got on the field. By the way, NFL players, if you weren't aware, are giant human beings, especially up close. We all know that, but up close, gigantic. And then Tuesday, the ceremony of the banner raising and all that. And they just go out and they played a Vegas game. They just played a Vegas game it was like they didn't skip a beat from the Stanley Cup playoffs. Defense was strong. Goaltending was good. They played a Vegas game. And that's what I think. Like, they're going to go through some adversity. They already are. Alec Martinez is out. Zach Whitecloud's out with injuries. Brett Howden suspended 2 games now. Will Carrier got hurt in that game. There's going to be adversity, but this team, I mean, we're going to be paying attention to them all season long. They're good, and they certainly have it in them to make another run here.
And they did all that while Seattle was waiting.
Yeah.
And just willing themselves to make a statement. And that's what's going to happen all year to Vegas. They're going to go into every town, or every team's going to come into Vegas, and they're going to say, Stanley Cup champs, let's make a statement. They're going to get get everybody's A game. There's going to be no hiding from it all year. That's what makes defending so hard.
Well, and Bruce Cassidy's talked about that. You know, he talked about that, and he said, listen, we're the measuring stick, and we want to stay the measuring stick. So we'll see if they can. I think they certainly can stay the measuring stick. But mentioned it before, Derek Van Deest, our writer out in Edmonton, he's actually in Calgary Thursday as we speak. We spoke to Derek about Chris Snow, the ceremony at the Saddle Dome where Kelsey, Cohen, and Willa were on the ice. We talked to him about the Jets signing Mark Scheifele and Connor Hellebuck, and a lot about the Oilers too. Here is that interview with Derek Van Deest. Derek, thanks so much for joining us. You're in Calgary right now, and obviously there for the funeral of Chris Snow. Very sad moment, but a really touching moment at the opener for the Flames where Snow's family was on the ice, Kelsey, Cohen, and Willa. You were in the building. What was that like?
It was very emotional. I think it's funny because a lot of players hadn't seen the family in a long time, and when I asked them about it after the game, they were kind of surprised that they were there, and it was a very emotional night. It was a very emotional way to start the season. Chris Snow meant a lot to a lot of people here in Calgary. He fought ALS for a long, long time, and for a long time he looked like he was doing well, and then suddenly he passed away. But it was It was a very emotional start to the season. I think you can just tell about how many people Chris touched in this city and how much people cared about him. And I, you know, I think the players were talking about how it was tough. It was a tough ceremony to get through, and just to watch Kelsey and the kids and how emotional they got with the support that they had for the family. So it was quite a touching moment last night. And you know, season opener, there's a lot of emotions to begin with, and just to kind of add that onto that. I know talking to some players and talking to Coach Ryan Huska after the game, he said it was tough. It was tough to get through.
Derek, it was tough to watch, never mind being there. I mean, you talk about Chris's legacy in Calgary, but it goes so far beyond that. It's across North America, right? I mean, he spent a lot of time in Minnesota covering the Wild. He was in Boston covering the Red Sox for the Boston Globe, the youngest writer, I think, ever to do that. People who have listened to this podcast a little bit know that Chris actually started his career with us at NHL.com covering college hockey with his dad, who also passed away from ALS, Bob, who was another wonderful man. So it was a really difficult thing to watch, but I was amazed at the strength of the Snow family. Kelsey continues to amaze me, and I told Emily Benjamin, one of our staff writers based out of Boston, who is really close with Kelsey, Chris was the best of the best. There's no other way to put it. He was the best of the best. He was better than all of us. So it was a really sad time, but you know, hopefully it brings more attention to this battle, and I know that's what Chris wanted. So hopefully we make some progress here in the near future.
And you're right. You know, he touched so many lives in so many cities, in Minnesota, in Boston, here in Calgary. They really kind of, you know, the Calgary became their home, and I think that was something that Calgarians really took to, is the fact that they, you know, they came to this community, they accepted the community, they loved this community, and the community loved them back. And you're right about Kelsey. She just shown so much strength in this whole thing since it began, since Chris was diagnosed, and since this battle began, she's shown so much strength with the family. And yeah, it was touching and moving, and she had a great interview in between the periods when she talked about his battle and the legacy that Chris wants to leave in the fight against ALS.
Yeah, and look, the Flames gave the Snows, you know, a little gift with a 5-3 win to open the night. I mean, trivial as it may be with the entire scope of what we're talking about here. But the opponent, let's get there, Derek, the opponent that they played, the Calgary Flames, the Winnipeg Jets, made huge news. And I'm going to tell you, for me, surprising news, shocking news, yep. Actually. Them signing Mark Scheifele and Connor Hellebuyck to matching 7-year contracts. That to me, I didn't see it coming. $8.5 million per. I was wondering, okay, the Jets are teetering, right? What direction are they going in? And because they got these guys signed, Scheifele and Hellebuyck, does it make you think that they're going now in a direction towards a Stanley Cup? I'm torn. I don't know that it does. I think if they let them go, traded them at some point this season, it might actually, it would be a step back to eventually take a couple steps forward. But these are good players too, and they're still in the prime of their career. So I'm torn on really what this means long-term for what the Winnipeg Jets are going after here.
Well, I think Winnipeg Jets is kind of a unique market because they don't attract a lot of free agents to come to Winnipeg. And so they have to draft well, they have to develop well, and then they have to treat their players well. And I think that was one of the reasons they went out and signed this deal. I think that the Jets believe that they're in a championship window right now. They've kind of retooled here a little bit by trading Pierre-Luc Dubois to Los Angeles. But they believe that they have the talent and enough players around to make a run. And you're looking at Connor Hellebuyck here, 7 years for 30-year-old goaltender. He's one of the best in the league. He's won the Vezina Trophy in 2020. So they wanted to kind of wrap him up, and he could have gone somewhere else. He could have looked, but I'm not sure someone else would have given him a 7-year deal at 30 years old. I think that was something that the Jets really kind of offered, and with Scheifele as well. He's been such a big part of this franchise for so long. He was the very first player ever drafted by Winnipeg when they moved here from Atlanta. So I think the strategy for the Jets is, we got to keep our own guys. We got to keep our own guys happy because we're not going to attract the fancy UFAs to come here to Winnipeg. And I think that's the strategy they've employed from the beginning, and that's the one they want to take. And you're right. It came as a surprise to a lot of people because everyone thought that they were going to either get traded or, you know, they were going to look at a free agent market, or maybe they would sign one of them, but maybe not necessarily both. But looking at that Winnipeg team and talking to those players and talking to management, they feel that they're in a championship window right now, and they just have the pieces to get there Whether they do or not, that's a different story. But last night, they were the better team against Calgary. They outshot them pretty badly, and they look good. They have a four-line team. They have really big, solid defensemen, and they have a world-class goaltender. So all the ingredients are there. It's just whether or not they put it together this season.
Yeah, I'm not sure they can put it together. I mean, you look at that team, it's almost the same team last year that lost to Vegas in the first round of the playoffs, and after the long overtime game, weren't even competitive in that series. And look, there were some injuries, and depth concerns me still, and no more Wheeler. So, you know, I'm curious. But the one thing that struck me in this whole thing, and I hadn't really thought about, was Scheifele, who's, you know, at times been demonized through this whole thing, through the playoffs last year and everything else, was him talking about Dale Hawerchuk and how that's who he wants to be. That's who was looking down at him, you know, when he signed this deal, that he wanted to be a lifetime Jet. Like, it's nice to hear in this age when players move so much that there still is some loyalty and there is still some meaning to being a lifetime player with a franchise. It's going to be Scheifele and Hellebuck who came up together and who are far closer than I actually thought they were, you know, judging from their interview. They're going to be the leading voices as they try to put the pieces together over the next 5 years.
Well, Scheifele also mentioned Steve Yzerman. Steve Yzerman played his entire career with the Detroit Red Wings, and that was a player that he idolized growing up. So he saw Steve Yzerman spend his entire career in Detroit, and he wanted to kind of be the same type of player where he spends his entire career in Winnipeg. So, yeah, there was a lot of influences there. Dale Hawerchuk, of course, had a huge influence in Winnipeg, and he didn't want to compare himself to Dale Hawerchuk. Dale Hawerchuk's a Hall of Famer. He did so many great things for that community. But he wanted to be a guy that's associated with Winnipeg when his career is up and done. And he will be if he sticks around for the length of this contract. He'll be 37 when it's up. So I think it just shows that there's a lot of pride in that room. There's a lot of pride in that team, in that organization. And I think that tells me something about how well they treat their players, because the guys that they've drafted and developed want to stay there.
Yeah, the one that was interesting to me, though, was Hellebuck, because he... You listening to his comments at the start of training camp, it didn't seem to me like he was married to the idea of staying in Winnipeg. Scheifele did. Like, you listen to Scheifele at the start of training camp, and it was like, this is where I want to be. I've let them know that. Hellebuck was a little more wishy-washy. So I guess, yeah, like you said, Derek, 7 years, you know, that's convincing, because I don't know who they were negotiating against for a 7-year deal. Do you think that was it? Yeah. That it was the fact that they gave him that 7 years? Because he goes to the open market as a 30, 31-year-old goalie. Yeah. Maybe it's 4 years, right?
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I think the 7 years was a big thing. And you're looking at that. And there was talk this offseason about, you know, trading him and what he would get on the open market. And you're right. They were talking 4, maybe 5. And the number was in that area of 6 to 8. It depends on who you were talking to and who needed a goaltender. I think everyone wants a really good goalie, but there was only certain teams that had the cap, the ability to fit him under the cap. So maybe him and his agent looked at that and said, hey, there's not a lot of options here, and no one's offering me 7 years. You're right. It looked like he was on his way out. It looked like he had one foot out the door, particularly after last year's playoffs. And I think that's why they brought in Laurent Brossoit. Because that was kind of plan B. It's like, hey, we can't keep Hellebuck. We got Laurent Brossoit here that could be our number one or number 1A guy. It'd be interesting who they were negotiating with, but I don't think anyone else was offering that kind of term for Connor Hellebuck. And so he looked at that. He looked at the loyalty of the club, and he said, hey, this is not a bad place to play.
No, I don't think it is. They're going to be lionized forever. I want to talk to you a little bit about your natural hometown. I know you're in Calgary now, but you spend most of your time in Edmonton. And I guess as somebody who assigned you some stories, I put a little curse on you. You have a big story on the site yesterday for the opener about how the Edmonton Oilers are developing a new defensive culture in their quest to win the elusive Stanley Cup. Yeah. And we've heard it from everybody. We heard it on this podcast from Leon Draisaitl, you know, saying that they need to learn how to not lose games instead of win games. And, you know, play a more 200-foot game, although Leon plays a 200-foot game. I think in many ways that's where his value is. And then they go out and they let Brock Besser score 4 goals in their opener, and it looks a little like the old-school Oilers.
You know what? It was the absolute worst start for this hockey team, and they're considered Stanley Cup contenders. And that's all they talked about in training camp is look how good defensively we were going to be, how much better this system is, and how we're going to protect the front of the net, and we're not going to give up three or four rebounds, and our goaltenders are going to be so much better this year. Stuart Skinner's going into his second season. He's going to be better. Jack Campbell's going to have a bounce back here. And lo and behold, Jack Campbell gives up 4 goals on 16 shots. Stuart Skinner comes in, and he gives up 4 goals, and it's just an absolute disaster for the Edmonton Oilers. And this is a team that is pegged to go far, and the Oilers themselves believe they can go far. But all the defensive struggles they had last season, all the defensive struggles they had in that series against the Vegas Golden Knights, all their goaltending issues that they had in the playoffs, all came back to light in one game. And I think that's really, there's a lot of egg on the faces of the Edmonton Oilers right now, because they were talking a good game. They look good in preseason. Jack Campbell only gave up 3 goals on 104 shots or something like that in the preseason. Everyone thought, great, he looks great. He got the start. He earned the start based on those preseason games. And he wasn't terrible by any means, but the defense in front of him was awful. And I think you're talking about they worked on this defensive structure all training camp, and it's a new defensive structure, and they're going to protect the front of the net. And you saw some of those goals. Guys are shooting from the slot. Guys are getting 2-3 rebounds, whacks in front of the net. I know there was a couple of unfortunate pucks off legs and things like that. But, yeah, it all came crashing down for the Edmonton Oilers, and they got 2 days to regroup because these two teams play again on Saturday.
So, Derek, this is a copycat league, many say, right? It's a copycat league, and they watched and lost to a team in Vegas last year that is the best at protecting the front of the net. They play from the front of the net out. Their defensemen, that is the system. Their defensemen protect the front, and they don't stray unless they absolutely have to. And look what it made Adin Hill, who was never a guy who anybody considered to be a number one goalie. And now look at him, right? Because of the system that they play. And what do they have in Vegas? They have big defensemen. Well, you know what? What do they have in Edmonton? They have big defensemen, a lot of them. And they need to play that way. I don't understand it. Like, it's a copycat league. You just lost to a team that plays that way. And you lost, big reason why, because they play that way. So why don't you try to adopt some of that? Take from what you lost and put it into your game. Is it just impossible for them to do that?
I just think with the personnel they have on the blue line, like, they do have some big defensemen. Darren Hayes is a big guy. He's a big stay-at-home guy. Matthias Ekholm was injured, so he may not be in the lineup for maybe another week or so. He's got some hip issues that seem to be worse than they are. But you look at Evan Bouchard. He's a big guy, but he's not an overly physical defenseman. He's a guy that gets beat. He's an offensive defenseman, makes a good first pass out of the zone, but he's not a big physical guy in front of his net. Darnell Nurse can be that guy. He's a big physical guy in front of his net. But then you look at Philip Broberg, who the Oilers are hoping it comes along, and they've been so patient with this player. He's a big guy, too, that can skate. Again, not overly physical in front of his own net. So I think that's maybe the difference between the Oilers and the Vegas Golden Knights. The Vegas Golden Knights had big, strong guys that you had to really fight through to get to the front of the net. And doing that in a series or in a game, you know, that's taxing after a while. The Oilers don't necessarily have that guy outside of Desharnais, who's basically in his first full season. He came up here last year, halfway through the year. So they don't have those huge pillars on defense. And you're expecting Darnell Nurse to do so much. So I think they want to play that game. And that's understandable. It is a copycat league. They see how one team wins the Stanley Cup, another team wants to copy it. But I'm not convinced they have the personnel to play that game. They're going to have to make some changes on the blue line. And last night, the Oilers' defense was abysmal. They were awful all the way down. They couldn't protect the front of the net. They couldn't win a battle in the corner. And that's an issue. And they got to really work on that. It was more will than skill last night that really kind of beat the Edmonton Oilers. And they got to be a lot stronger on the puck in their own end. And I think that was showcased last night. To be fair,
Matthias Ekholm was out, and that's a huge loss for them. That's going to affect them defensively. And Dan loves the Vegas defense. He thinks it's like the Montreal Canadiens from like their glory years, right? With Larry Robinson and all those guys on it. Greatest defense ever in the history of the NHL. The Vegas Golden Knights defensemen have a lot of help in their own end. All of their guys play between the circles. There's nobody floating at the blue line. There's nobody releasing the zone until they have possession of the puck. There's none of that. That's all over Edmonton's game, right? And that leaves the defense in a bad position, right? There's no continuity in the defensive zone. And you could say you worked on it during the preseason, and that's fine. It's going to take a while to gel. Like, I'm not overly concerned yet. For Edmonton, this is an 82-game trial run. Let's figure out what works and let's do it. We're going to finish in the top three. We're going to be considered a favorite when we get there because we have the two best players in hockey. So let's figure out how we're going to play and how it's going to work. But to lay this all at the feet of the six guys that happen to skate on the blue line and say that they're nowhere in the realm that Vegas is and they never could be is in part. They're not because they're far more offensive than defensive than that group. But it's also whistling past the graveyard because Vegas gets all kinds of help. You know, you talk about what the Vegas defense made Aiden Hill look like. What is the Vegas offense and the system that Bruce Cassidy has made those six defensemen in Vegas look like? He's going to make them all money when it's over.
No, that's true. And I think the one thing that stood out for me in Vegas, you know, covering them to the Stanley Cup finals is they don't lose a lot of puck battles. That's the thing. They don't lose puck battles along the wall. They don't lose puck battles in the corner. They don't lose puck battles in front of the net. And I think that's what the Oilers did last night. They lost every puck battle. And I think there's one thing to say, oh, you're big and strong, but you got to go in and you got to win those pucks in the corner. And you got to win those rebounds. And I think that's the big thing about Vegas is that they protect the front of the net because they win those puck battles in front of the net. They win those puck battles in the corner. They win those puck battles in the neutral zone. And I think that was the big thing. And I think if there's a takeaway from Vegas winning the Stanley Cup is that you need to have guys that will win those puck battles. They'll go in a corner, and 9 or 10 times, they'll come out of the corner with it. And I think that's something that the Oilers still have to work on.
As much as I do like the Vegas defense, Sean, this like dislikes the Oilers' 200-foot game for their forwards as much. He thinks it's like a 150-foot game. But I'm just going to point that out there. Derek, thanks so much for joining us. This was great. You're in Calgary now. Be back in Edmonton shortly. You got the West covered for us. Appreciate it, man.
Appreciate it. This was fun. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks to Derek for joining us. A lot of good stuff there with the Oilers. He was honest about the Oilers' 8-1 loss, let's say, and I think we all have to be about where they're at right now. But, Sean, let's switch conferences and let's go to Buffalo. The Sabres open their season tonight, Thursday night, against the New York Rangers at home, and they've made some pretty big news this week. Owen Power signs a 7-year deal, $58.45 million. That's an $8.35 million AAV. Starts next season. Rasmus Dahlin signs an 8-year deal, $88 million, $11 million AAV, 2 days earlier from Power signing. So you got your D locked up. You got your cornerstone, number one picks, number one pick Dahlin in 2018, number one pick Power in 2020. They are locked up, and they're not the only ones in Buffalo. Matthias Samuelsson on D, locked up for a long term. You got Tage Thompson, who you're going to hear from on this podcast in a few minutes, locked up. Dylan Cousins, locked up. The core is set in Buffalo. They need the goalie to come through. They need the other guys to come through. But, man, I mean, the Buffalo Sabres, Sean, locking up these two. And we knew they were going to sign him, but just getting him signed long-term, getting him to buy in, I think it says a lot for where the Sabres are, that these two guys who could have signed the bridge deals to really kind of test where they are and where the Sabres are, bought in all the way.
Yeah, and I think that's the biggest thing. And Kevin Adams, their GM, talked about it, right? To be able to get those commitments, you look at, you know, we talked a lot about Vegas. You look at Jack Eichel and, you know, the fact that he was willing to move on and ready to move on. You're not seeing that from their marquee players now. They want to stay. You know, Alex Tuck came back in that deal. He's all in Buffalo. You know, some of the other pieces they got from various deals they've made. Like, and look, when Buffalo's good, that's a great hockey town. Like, fantastic. The players are treated like kings. It's a good living situation. A lot of guys still live in that Western New York area, right, after they get out of hockey. You know, it's a great place to be. I went to school out there. Like, no, there's no better place to be as long as you don't mind the cold, right?
And deal with and that, most, yeah.
Most hockey players don't. So,
no.
You know, but otherwise, they're kings, right? When they're good, even when they're not good, they're pretty omnipresent. And now, as they get better, like that town's just waiting to embrace them and to explode. And you saw it happen with the Bills and where they are now. So as a young player, I don't know why you wouldn't buy in. You kind of look around. You go, hey, we got two really good young goalies. You know, our core set. We like our coach. Our GM has made some really good moves. We're on the way up, and let's buy in and let's send a message to everybody else, because it does send a message to the rest of the league. Hey, what's going on in Buffalo? Why are all these guys so invested? And when I become a free agent, maybe that's someplace I look when traditionally it hasn't been.
Yeah, and I do find it interesting and smart, you know, because of the way they've drafted and the picks that came up in the years they had the number one picks and Dahlin and Power. Your cornerstone guys, and this is with all due respect to Thompson and Cousins and you know, guys like Tuck and Jack Quinn coming up too. The cornerstone is the top two defensemen that you got, and you can play them together, you can play them apart, but they're your number one and number two, and they will be for a long time, the tandem, if you will. In Edmonton, it's Draisaitl and McDavid. In Pittsburgh, for the longest time, it's been Malkin and Crosby with Letang, right? In Washington, it was Ovechkin and Backstrom, right? In Buffalo, it's Dahlin and Power. And I'm now curious, as I'm sure everybody else is, how do they handle the expectations? Because the expectations are higher now. It no longer are the Buffalo Sabres the team that is supposed, you know, okay, they may sneak up, they're building, they're growing. No. Buffalo Sabres are supposed to be a playoff team now. So that's the next step in handling the challenge and handling the expectations. I certainly think their core guys can do it. But can they do it and lead the rest of the group in that direction as well? They had a good last season. They was a good trial run, and they have to avoid the slumps of last season. That's the key thing. They had two major slumps last season, and it cost them. They missed the playoffs by 1 point. You don't go through those slumps. Heck, you go through one instead of two. They're a playoff team. And Florida's not, by the way, if they do that. That's the consistency. That's the challenge. It starts tonight, Thursday night against the New York Rangers. But that's what you have to see now from Buffalo. These guys are locked up. All right, now, here it is. The expectation is to go into the playoffs this season.
You know what they remind me of, what they're building towards? Because you mentioned all those duos, right? What they're building towards is the Anaheim Ducks Stanley Cup team. That's the last team I can remember that was built on two dominant defensemen as the core, right? And they weren't homegrown. It was Brian Burke, and he brought in Pronger, and he brought in
Scott Niedermayer.
Yeah. And they drove that championship. Like, you'd be hard pressed after Timo Solani and to name three forwards on that team.
Well, yeah, Getzlaff and Perry, but, you know, they were still early in their careers, too.
They were very early in their careers.
They weren't Getzlaff and Perry yet.
Yeah.
They were good players, but they weren't what they became in Anaheim at that point. So I got to understand what your point is. They had Timo Solani and a couple of guys you were hoping for, but you had Pronger.
Yeah, and they had Paul Kariya.
You had Niedermayer. Yeah.
And you know, just, but it was built from the back. And that was who they were. And that's who Buffalo is going to be. They got some nice pieces up front, but they're going to be built from the back. Those two guys are going to be the cornerstones, hopefully, for the next decade. And I don't know if it ends up the same way, but as you were talking, that's what it reminded me of. I started thinking about that championship Ducks team and how what its DNA was. And I think Buffalo's DNA is going to be very similar.
Well, and they did have a pretty monstrous forward on that team in Ryan Getzlaff. And we talked to a monstrous Buffalo Sabres forward, Tage Thompson. You remember at Player Media Tour when we talked to him, and this interview's from Player Media Tour before training camp opened. He walked in the room and we were like, oh boy, that's a tall man. And he is a tall man. And here's the interview with Tage Thompson.
Tage, thanks for joining us. There's a lot to get to, obviously, but we can start with the hockey stuff. The Sabres, so close last year. Is it time? Is it time to end this drought in Buffalo?
It is time. A lot of us thought last year was, you know, our time, and like you said, we fell just short. I think that leaves a bitter taste in all of our mouths. So heading into this season, I think you know, a lot of guys playing with a chip on our shoulder, and we definitely have a lot to prove.
How much has the continuity helped in the fact that you've all grown up together, you've experienced these disappointments together, the people that had to leave left, and what's left is what's going after this?
Yeah, it's been good. I think that's definitely something that's going to be important for us going forward, the fact that we have pretty much the same group of guys, and there's been minimal to no turnover, I think, is something that is important. Having the guys that have had the ups and downs and going through that together, so as we try to chase that common goal, we're all aware of, where we've fallen short in the past and what we need to do to improve.
With that minimal turnover also is a sign, too, from management, right? Like, they believe, right? And do you feel that belief from them because of – is that a reason that you you feel it?
Yeah, I think you feel it. I think the city feels it. For sure in the locker room, we believe in our core group of guys, and I think we know we have something special, and I think that's kind of why there's so much excitement is we know we're capable of doing something that not a lot of people expect us to do. So that internal expectation is a lot higher for sure.
Do more people expect it now, though? Like you just said, not a lot of people expect us to, but it seems like more and more people are expecting more out of the Sabres now.
Yeah, I think more and more people are starting to expect more out of us. But I still think that they haven't really seen the level of excitement or belief that we have in our locker room. I think there's a lot of stuff behind the scenes that, fans don't get to see, and all the work that, our team and certain individuals put into getting better, game by game. I think is just something that we know internally we have a special group that's capable, and I think people on the outside are starting to see that, and that's kind of what we're hoping to prove.
As you go through this process and you've gotten incrementally better, what's it like in Buffalo? That's such a crazy sports city. The reward, the payoff, is to get into the playoffs, but it's also to have that city embrace the Sabres like they once did. What's that been like as it's kind of built and you've become more relevant in that city?
Yeah, I think we're all feeling that too as a team. I think we can sense kind of the city rallying behind us, and they can start to sense we're right there, on the verge of making playoffs and competing for cups. And I think that gets them excited, and the fact that they're getting excited gets us excited. So it's kind of a two-way street there. And they haven't had that in a while. So for us to be able to say we're the group that did that is something that motivates us a lot.
There's a lot of guys around that team that were successful, that work in broadcasting or work in the front office or whatever it might be. They've experienced that. Are those stories shared, with Marty Biron or Rob Ray or whoever it might be, kind of you don't want to say the glory days, but what that city can be like? And do you think about that and what you could experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something that all of us firsthand want to witness for ourselves. I mean, we hear stories, like you said, you talk to guys that have stuck around in Buffalo, either played there or grew up in that time frame where they were successful, and you hear how amazing the city was and, how passionate the fans are. I mean, you get to see it with the Bills right now and everything that goes on there. So that's something that we really want. We want our fan base to, to be excited to go to games and be excited for, winning seasons. And we want to witness that firsthand and have that, reliving of the glory days, I guess you could say.
Did you know that Buffalo was such like this type of raging hockey market before you got there?
Growing up, I always knew Buffalo was known as a passionate sports fan base.
Yeah.
Hockey and football, but you hear certain stories now living in Buffalo, and I don't think you realize the magnitude of the fandom there and until you're actually living in the city. And even then, right, like I said, you want to experience that for yourself firsthand. I've been to a couple of Bills games, and you can't even describe them. It's just kind of something you got to go witness. And, yeah. We're hoping for, the Buffalo Sabres to kind of be the Bills, like, in that sense.
Do you ever jump through a table?
I haven't, no. But I don't think you can consider yourself a true Bills fan unless you have. So
yeah,
that might be on the agenda.
Mustard or ketchup or both?
Yeah, mustard and ketchup. They got that guy there, eh, that sprays everyone. So anytime I've been there, I haven't really seen that yet. But, like I said, they're a passionate fan base. They have fun. They love their sports teams. And all they demand is that you work hard. So I think that's kind of hit home with all of us. And that's something that we want to give back to the fans.
You, last season, had a big year, the 47 goals, 94 points. What's the next step? For you, I mean, we know what it is for the team.
Yeah.
What's it for you?
50? I mean, you could put numbers and stuff, but I think it's just consistently trying to get better each season. For me, I approach every season trying to outdo myself from the previous season. So I think, yeah, 50 would be a good number for me to hit, and you know, hopefully 100 points. You always set those internal personal goals for yourself heading into the season, but you know, whether or not I'm showing up on the stat sheet, it's how am I helping us win? And for me, that is when I'm scoring and putting up points. But there's other areas of my game that I can improve on that don't show up on the stat sheet, whether that's just being more solid defensively. Maybe I get a bigger role on the PK this year. Just certain things like that, and improving in the faceoff dot. Little things that add up over the course of the year. You know, we miss playoffs by 1 point, so there's always little ways you can add to your game, whether or not you're showing up on the stat sheet.
50 goals has always been a magical number in the NHL. It's kind of the demarcation line, right, between good and great. Like, if you're a 50-goal scorer, you're elite. You grew up in an era where you were a kid and you saw 50-goal scorers, and you're like, wow, they're really good. Do you have a new appreciation for how hard 50 is?
Yeah, I mean, I think just scoring in general in the NHL is tough to do. You know, coming into the league the first few years, obviously it took a little bit for me to adjust to, and a lot of other players go through their own adjustment period as well. And I think to be able to score in this league is something that is very tough, and I think it gives you you know, a greater appreciation as you approach it and get closer and closer to that number. You know, how hard it was to get there and still how far away you are from it. So I think it just kind of leaves that hunger and kind of that bittersweet taste in your mouth. You know you're close, but still have a lot of work to do.
Did it become harder as you got closer because of the pressure and the again, the magicness of that number? It's a number you want to reach selfishly because then you can put yourself in very elite company.
Yeah, I think it gets harder. Whether it's the outside pressure, I don't know if it's so much that. I think it's more just kind of internal pressure maybe that you put on yourself. But I think, too, like as you score more people are aware of you, and you know, you get less time and space out there, so you have to find new ways to create time and space for yourself, and it's just kind of a constant adjusting on trying to create offense for yourself and for your teammates. And luckily I've been able to play with, you know, a lot of great teammates, a lot of great line mates that have been able to open up ice for me out there and made my job a lot easier.
I'm sitting here wondering, you're 6'6", right?
Yep.
And you're known to be a scorer, you can shoot, your stick handling is elite in this league. How, at 6'6", can you do that? And what was it like growing into your body to get those skills to do that?
Yeah, I think for me, that's something where I think a lot of people don't know that I wasn't always crazy big growing up. I was always average to, you know, I was always tall, but not, you know, a lot taller than my peers. And when I was younger, I always had really good hands and a knack for scoring and making plays, and was kind of just an average size guy and on all my teams. And then hit a pretty big growth spurt 1 year when I went to the program and grew 5 inches over the course of the season, and felt so awkward throughout the whole course of the season. And I think once I kind of got out of that awkward stage, which took maybe, you know, 3-4 years, even into my first couple pro years, just getting comfortable with my body. I think once I was comfortable, the hands and the shot and the offense, kind of just all those instincts just kind of stick with you.
Do you watch taller players?
Growing up, my favorite player was Malkin, so I always watched him. And yeah, he's a taller player, and I feel like I've tried to replicate my game after him a little bit. Definitely add things that he does to my game, and he's someone that I enjoyed watching growing up. So I for sure tried to, you know, emulate him.
Yeah, I was thinking Mario. Like, he's so tall, and nobody thinks of it until you see him, and he's a giant, right? Like, but he played a smaller game, like. There's two ways to do it, right? You either play into your body and you crash and bang, or you're more of a finesse player. I guess Malkin maybe is a little bit of both.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's what I loved watching about him, especially once I did go through that growth spurt, is I feel like I could kind of relate to that a little bit more, just being a bigger guy that maybe other people saw me playing a different role than what I felt I was best suited for. And I think for me, it was just not trying to conform to something that I wasn't, and just, you know, kind of sticking to what I believed I knew I could be, and trusting the process and the work that I was putting in that it would all pay off.
Was that surprise to you, the growth spurt that you went to, especially at that, you know, later stage, you know, of your youth?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I always believed that I'd be on the taller side. Just growing up, I wasn't small by any right. means, but I didn't think I was gonna, you know, kind of just shoot up 5 inches in 1 year and be a.
It's crazy. It's a crazy amount in 1 year. Yeah.
And yeah, my father's 6'3", and so I figured I'd be kind of right around there. And you know, 6'1" is not small by any means. So going into that season, just shooting up, you know, 4 or 5 inches, whatever it was pretty drastic, and it definitely took some adjusting to get used to the body and feel comfortable and coordinated, I guess you could say. And I think obviously once I did go through that, it's made me better for sure.
What did your parents say when you came home? You were at the program, at the national team program, like yeah. you said. Like, so you're gone for that year. Like, my son's a freshman in college now, and I haven't seen him in a little bit, but I can't imagine him coming home 5 inches taller than when I dropped him off.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think they were shocked for sure. I think I came home for Christmas, like, halfway through the year, and they were both, like, taken back by how tall I was, and obviously still really skinny and probably really awkward looking, but... I think that's something that they had to get used to probably just as much as I did, not seeing me for such a long time. And then I think after the season too, going into that summer, probably had a lot of getting used to see me at 6'4", 6'5", after being, you know, 6'1", 160.
Your dad bounced around a lot, right? Yeah. As a player and as a coach. I think you were born in Phoenix. You went to school in Michigan, UConn, college. Where's home?
I think I consider home Arizona. You know, it's where I was born. My mom's side of the family lives in Arizona. We go back there every summer. My wife and I have a house there. That's just kind of what I consider home. Like you said, I've been everywhere, so it's kind of hard to pinpoint a place where I'm technically from. I've lived in so many places, but I feel like I've had the most consistency probably of going back to Arizona.
I would assume it's a little difficult as a kid to move around that much, but do you think in the end it helped you?
I think it helped me for sure, especially going into this lifestyle. You know, you got to be able to be adaptive, be able to pick up and go, and you know, whether it's trades, signing on a new team, being sent down, called up, you got to be flexible. And I think it's something that not a lot of people outside of hockey understand how mentally, you know, mentally tough it is. It's not an easy thing to do, just pack up your life and move, and really not be able to make any plans for your future. So I think going through that at a young age has kind of been second nature to us, and something that's pretty much all I've known since I've been a little kid. So it's definitely helped me for, you know, pursuing this dream.
And socially too, to walk into a locker room with 20 new guys. I mean, you had to do that at school all the time.
Yeah, I think for my family and I think we moved every 2 to 3 years, you know, whether my dad was coaching or playing. That kind of typically seemed like our time frame. So to be able to just pick up, move, and, you know, go to a new city, meet new 20 friends and your hockey team and a new school, I think it teaches you how to, you know, meet new friends and kind of just be outgoing, I guess.
Great interview from Tage Thompson, and we thank him for joining us. We'll stay in that corner of the world. You know, last night was the centennial in Boston, the 100-year celebration. They had their all-centennial team. They brought a lot of them into Boston. My daughter was watching with me, and as they were introducing some of the players, and the highlights were in black and white, and she was like, "Did you used to watch hockey in black and white?" And I was like, "Yeah, I did." And she's like, "Well, Dad, you're old." So yeah. I had that going for me. But it was awesome. You know, we always talk about how Montreal is the bellwether for how they do these big events, and they are. But I thought Boston did a really great job with what they did. And the star power was unbelievable, right? Bobby Orr, Espo in the same building. Some of the newer players, you know, Zdeno Chara was there, and Patrice Bergeron, and Tim Thomas made it back. It was a really cool little snapshot of Boston's history, which is obviously deep because they're 100 years old. But I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was very cool to see. And by the way, I love the uniforms that they wore too in the game. Those were sweet. But it was one. There was one moment, and I caught it on TNT when they were showing some of the, you know, the former players, the alumni who were part of the Centennial team coming into T-Mobile Arena. There was a moment where Phil Esposito was going up the escalator, and he turned around, and right behind him, and he didn't know he was there. He turned around, right behind him was Bobby Orr. And he just kind of gave him like, oh, hello, I can't believe you're right. You know, it was just one of those, it's a cool moment. Like, here's Espo going up, and there's Bobby Orr right behind him. And then Patrice Bergeron came through, and David Krejci came through, and so many others. Milan Lucic said after the game on an interview with TNT, he said, listen, I haven't seen Tim Thomas in a very long time. That was kind of cool. But you look around, you look on the ice, and I'm looking at, I couldn't help but think, man, this team could really use Patrice Bergeron, couldn't he? He's in the building. Maybe they can suit him up for at least another game or two. And they're not going to, but yeah, I like what they're doing. It's a 100-year celebration of a legendary Original Six organization. It's a very cool thing, and they're going to be celebrating it all season.
Yeah, and Patrice Bergeron looked like he could still play 20 minutes.
Just did.
Well, I know, but he looked fantastic, right? Yeah. And you kind of wonder, you're like, why? Why did he stop? For me, the highlight was Terry O'Reilly, right? And he finally is starting to look old, but he was my guy when I was a kid, the Tasmanian devil, and he would take on everybody. And, you know, all these guys that you grew up loving, Jerry Cheevers, and even Cam Neely, they're all gray now. And I know I'm right behind him. So while it was cool to see everybody, it's a little bittersweet because I know it's coming for me next.
Well, your daughter's telling you watched games in black and white. So there you go. I didn't watch games in black and white, Sean. Just going to point that out there.
You're a youngin'.
Yeah, very young, definitely. So listen, I got a question, a couple more things before we get out of here. I got a question that I loved for my weekly mailbag, which ran on Wednesday. The Manning cast on ESPN for Monday Night Football. It's a cool thing that they do, Peyton and Eli Manning, right? That the secondary, you know, way to watch the game, if you will. So if we were to do in the NHL a Manning cast style broadcast, who should be on it? I was asked for my top five candidates. I'm gonna give you the list that I gave. Kevin Weeks, energy, you know, entertainment, passion for the game, educating the viewer. I think he would be terrific. Kevin Bieksa has got a great wry sense of humor, plus knows the game really well, does a great job on Sportsnet. I think he'd be good. Colby Armstrong. Guys love Colby Armstrong. They open up to Colby Armstrong, and he's a fun broadcaster as well. He would have a lot of different things to say as the game was going on, and he's got some great stories. He's got some legendary AHL stories too. Ray Ferraro, just an absolute legendary broadcaster, knows the game back and front, passion for it. He'd be an obvious candidate. And the wild card, we talked about him before, just, you know, with his playing days with the Anaheim Ducks, Chris Pronger, he's not involved, but if they could get Chris Pronger to do some broadcasting, I think Chris Pronger would be excellent at it. I think he would be good because he's quick-witted, and that's what you need on a Manning cast broadcast like that. So I got Weeks, Bieksa, Armstrong, Ferraro, and Pronger. Those would be my top five. If you had two, I'm not going to go there, but that would be, the question was top five. Would you add to the list?
Well, yeah. Well, first of all, it's the dynamic. You just named five guys. You
got to find some. Yes, it's the dynamic, of course.
You got to find somebody that they play off of, and you missed the perfect opportunity. It's a direct steal of the Manning cast. It's the Pronger cast, because Chris's brother Sean, is quicker and funnier than Chris, and that's hard to do. He wrote that book, The Journeyman, which is just an unbelievable tell-all. Like, some of the stories he has are unbelievable. And he, like I said, he's quicker and funnier. And between them, they have so many stories from college all the way through to winning the Stanley Cup. So that's perfect. Another guy that I would suggest, and we've had him on our show a ton of times, is Mike McKenna. I think he's fantastic at stuff like that. So, but you would need to find, and here's my third one. This is a complete wild card. You put Henrik and Tuukka together. The two goalies. And the just goalies. Let them go.
A Swede and a Finn. I like that.
Little warring factions. There will always be a little bit of tension there. Maybe Tuukka will throw a milk crate now and then. Who knows?
And maybe Henrik will yell at him.
Henrik will be really well-dressed the whole time. It'll be like a Suits episode.
That's good. I'm watching Suits right now.
I'm going to Steve Mayer with that one.
I like it. I like the idea. I mean, I'm all for stealing ideas. You know, ESPN's a partner. Steal the idea. I'm good with it. So that would be, if they were to do that, it'd be fun. So some good candidates there. The other one I thought of was Joe Thornton, but I don't think you'd get him to do it. But that would be interesting, to say the least. Of course, you could do Brady and Matthew Tkachuk, but they're playing right now. So we can't do it that way right now. Last thing, well, second to last thing before we go, Sean. 2 days in, right? 17 teams have played. 11 more tonight, Thursday night. Overreaction. Overreactions are fun. So I'm going to give you an overreaction. I want you to give me an overreaction. This one's got me shaking my head. That Jonathan Drouin's going to come out and have this all-world season because he's playing on a line right now with Nathan MacKinnon and Mikko Rantanen. He looked good. That line looked great. He had an assist. He played 17-plus minutes. Jonathan Drouin may have the best season of his career. May. But it's way, way, way too early to suggest that he's going to live up to the hype now that he came into the league with when he was drafted 10 years ago. This guy hasn't played a full season since 2018-19. He's got to stay healthy. He's got to stay healthy. And are we 100% sure he's going to stay on a line with MacKinnon and Rantanen all season long? I mean, looks good now, but we know how lines change. I've heard a lot about Jonathan Drouin, how this is the year for Drouin. This is the best landing spot ever, and it might be. But I just want to reel it in a little bit. Slow down on it, because Jonathan Drouin, like I said, has been pretty much a 50-game player in his career. Let's be an 82-game player.
Yeah, okay. Prove it, right? And for me, the biggest overreaction is everybody walking in and looking at the Vegas Golden Knights and saying, you know what? I don't have a really good goalie, but that's okay. I have two decent goalies. I can win the cup. It doesn't work that way, right? That was a special circumstance. There were a lot of things that came together to make that happen. Look, you don't need Marty Brodeur anymore playing 78 out of 82 games. And I think it's better for you to, you know, have a 50-32 split or whatever it might be. But you still need a pretty good goalie to win a Stanley Cup. And for all these teams that are looking at 2A and 2B and saying, well, there's my tandem, I got as good a shot as anybody, or the fan base doing that, you might want to slow your roll a little bit and reconnect to reality.
You know what you also need to win a Stanley Cup, Sean? A Vegas-style defense. Just going to bring it back to that.
Yeah, I know.
You see it, you know, you do. You do. And let's give respect to Adin Hill here. He's been... You know, he played really well, but you need that Vegas-style defense, too. That helps. That helps. And, yes, I love the way they did play. I love the way the Blues played in 2019, too. It was the same style. Bruins had it, too, that year. Same style of defense.
Yeah, yeah. Nope, they're the studs of the strip, Dan.
They are the studs of the strip. Anyway, last thing before we go, Barry Melrose, long-time analyst on ESPN, former coach, player. Really, I mean, he became a legend in the game over the last 4 or 5 decades. Barry Melrose, as we all know, if you're a hockey fan, you know this unless your head's stuck in the mud. Barry Melrose announced his retirement this week. He's dealing with Parkinson's disease. So I just wanted to end the podcast, Sean, by giving our best to Barry Melrose. He now watches from the sidelines, watches on at home from the couch, and just wish him all the best as he deals with Parkinson's.
Yeah, of course, a horrible disease, and you know, you feel bad for anybody that's afflicted with it, and you do hope for the best. Look, Barry's been involved in the game for almost 50 years, player, coach, broadcaster, whatever it is. You know, the first time I ever met Barry was in 1995. I was covering the Devils and the Detroit Stanley Cup Final, and we were in Detroit, and ran into him on an off night, and... it was like royalty, right? Like, because you had grown up as a kid watching that ESPN2 hockey night thing. Like, that was the closest thing Americans had to hockey night in Canada. It was the first real hockey show that we had ever seen. And all the people that were involved in that, they were stars, right? And Barry was the brightest amongst all of them. So, you know, again, just tragic. And you saw the outpouring, the genuine outpouring of everybody that he's ever worked with, everybody that he's ever encountered. about their concern for him and their well wishes. And that's because he's a genuine hockey guy, right? Whenever you saw him, you knew he'd have a story and a smile and a handshake. And that's what hockey's known for. And none of them are more true to that creed than Barry Melrose.
100% well said. And by the way, Barry Melrose, in the prime of his broadcasting career, would be a perfect Manning Cast guy. He would have been perfect at that.
Yeah, again, you just got to find the right partner.
You do. But no, we wish Barry the best. Sean, this was fun. We thank Derek Van Deest, our colleague based at Edmonton, and Tage Thompson. We played that interview as well. A lot of hockey coming at you. We're into it now, into the regular season. Two nights down. I think it's like 178 more to go. Enjoy the hockey.